Willkommen zur vorerst letzten Folge unserer Gesprächsreihe anlässlich des 40. Jahrestags der Ermordung von Edward Pimentel in Wiesbaden. In der heutigen Folge sprechen wir noch einmal mit Kathleen Pequeño, der Schwester von Edward. Wer unsere erste Folge mit Kathleen noch nicht gehört hat, sollte das unbedingt vorher tun. Im heutigen Gespräch wird es unter anderem um einen Dokumentarfilm gehen, der Kathleen bei ihrer Reise nach Deutschland begleitet, bei der sie in Beziehung tritt mit ehemaligen Angehörigen der Roten Armee-Fraktion. Den Film könnt ihr online kostenlos ansehen. Den Link findet ihr wie immer in den Shownotes. Mein Kollege Matthias Gattoff und ich, Ture Alting, haben das Gespräch wieder gemeinsam geführt. Die Folge ist auf Englisch. Ein Link zum deutschen Transkript findet ihr ebenfalls in den Shownotes. Kathleen, we are so grateful you've joined us again. Welcome back. To begin, what was it like for you to be part of the film and to share Edward's and your story so openly?
Well, I was starting a restorative justice project for myself. I mean, I would say that's one of the funny things is people think the film was the project, but I'm like, oh no, the film was my friend's project. around 1999 was the first time I set foot in a prison for the first time. And I was it was 3 years after, Birgit Haugefeld had been arrested, I want to say. I'm trying to remember the timeline of her. Yeah, she was arrested in 96, in an action where Wolfgang Grams was killed. I think I learned about it in 1999, at which point I also learned about the death of Wolfgang Grams. And I was like, and I learned a little bit about some of the writing that I think Birgit had done that was already out by then, or some interviews that she had given where she talked about being in solitary for years. And I think in 1999, it was a really, 1999 was a really profound year for me. It was the time that my first godchild came into my life was a boy. And so, with boys, you are always thinking in the US, like, oh my gosh, someday they're going to sign up and they're going to make them sign up for the army. And right now they're just a cute little baby. I learned a bunch about Birgit Haugefeld's imprisonment and the death of Wolfgang Grams. And I was like, I remembered that I had spent years wishing for harm to come to them. And I think that's also when you realize, like, it is, and then I was like, right. And then harm did come to them. And I was like, I don't really know. I mean, I was basically like, what sort of, monster am I, to wish that? And then to find out that it happened and be like, it doesn't make me any better. It doesn't heal me. It doesn't feel just, And yeah, I mean, I come back to over and over. If the worst thing about murder is that it takes away people's future, then I can't be a person who cheers that on or says like, that's going to solve our problems. And I went into a prison for the first time and I met a bunch of guys who were older than me, and a bunch of them were Latino guys, and many of the guys I got to know going in, I started going in more often. They were trying to make their long prison sentences more bearable for themselves. And most interestingly, they were trying specifically to make it better for each other. Like, they were actually trying to help each other inside. I remember one of the first things that I encountered them doing was they were trying to do a campaign because the rules of the prison were only explained in English. And so when new people would come into the prison and they didn't speak English, they would just be punished for rules that they had never understood or were ever explained to them. And the punishments would include isolation, strip searches, like removal of privileges, like all these things. And so a bunch of the guys in this group, the Chicano Culture Club, were specifically, like, they were like, they were trying to make something better for somebody else, right? Like they were fine. They understood the rules. They were there a long time. They were just watching these guys, and so they organized a campaign where they wanted to translate the prison materials into Spanish and make them available to people coming in so that they weren't just punished as soon as they came in, because they were like, there's no reason to make it worse. It's already bad enough being here, and I supported them with that campaign, and I started going in more and more and getting to know them. And that's also when I was really like, prison is the main solution we have to homicide. And it seems like they have things that they probably ought to be doing. Like, I mean, I'll say too, I don't think like you commit a homicide, you should get to just go about your business. I think there are things you have to do. And someone told me this years later that they worked with incarcerated women who had committed, a bunch of them had committed homicides, and they said, we have things to do, but we can't do them in here. Like, we have things to do to make things as right as we can. And I've been really lucky to get to know any number of people who have committed homicides who have in fact said, well, now I have things to do. Like, I can't let up now working for justice and working for healing. And a lot of those people are my friends. And I learn a lot from them. And they learn a lot from me. And you're like, what did I actually ask Kathleen? I thought
No
that was the
worries.
answer too.
It's so
Okay.
interesting listening to you. But maybe you could tell us, how did being part of the film project feel for you?
Oh, the film project. Oh, I mean, I was so in about 2010, after years of visiting people inside and supporting them and needing any number of people who'd committed homicides and had regrets and were trying to figure out how their lives were different and what they were, how they wanted to be different. I was interested to figure out if any of the former members of the RAF felt the same. And so I wanted to do that project. And then I just happened to reconnect with my friend who knew me at the time. She was one of only a few people who knew that my brother had been murdered when we were in high school. I mean, I didn't tell people for 2 years. Like, she was really one of my closest friends in high school. And I think she was also, because she only knew me in that time, and Des and I had been close in high school, and because I came out as a lesbian, but not to most people, and I was just so much more like an angry person who couldn't really maintain a relationship if it wasn't about anger. But like she and I lost touch. And so we didn't talk for like 20 years. And then 20 years? Yeah, just over 20 years. And then when we reconnected, she was like, what do you do? And I was like, oh, I work with people who are incarcerated. I help them make prison conditions, better. I help them figure out how to get out if they should be out in the community. And I try to figure out how to have fewer people go to prison if it, whenever there is a better solution. And Des was like, what happened? Like, I don't know who this person is. I kind of like her. She's a little easier to be around, which is funny. I was like, oh yeah, Des is still like smart and funny and interesting. Like, but she was like, you seem really different. And so then I was like, yeah, I've been working with incarcerated people for years, and I think I'm ready to do this project where I think I want to go try and meet with the people who killed my loved one, or in any connection with that action. I was like, it's complicated because it's the RAF, and so no one's going to want to talk with me. I was very specific, like, I don't want to talk about anything leading up to the murder because I don't want to wind up in any sort of German criminal legal system case. And so and she was like, that sounds really interesting, can I film it? And I was like, oh, it'll be like a home movie. I knew nothing about it. If I had actually known, I think like many things in life, like many great things in life, if I had actually known how hard it would be to have that project be filmed, I would not have said yes. I would have said no. Like, I'm just gonna go do this thing. But I wanted a record of it for myself. These things are so emotional for me, and later I'm usually like, I don't remember anything about it. So it just seemed like it would be like just like a slightly longer home movie. And I also thought it would be easier. I mean, honestly, I did not think I would stretch out over, what it did many, I want to say like almost a decade I spent, trying to find people to talk to me and then in doing this project. So yeah, the film came about because I had no idea like what it would be like. And then over the course of the film, I think Des wound up looking more and more at our relationship. And that was also really interesting because our relationship changed, and she told me things that I hadn't understood about, our relationship at the time, which includes her basically being like, yeah, Kathleen is like a lot. And that was part of how we wound up not being friends. I find myself so curious how you will translate that. Because yeah, people, sometimes people will say, and this is true, I am what we call in English extra. Like, you're like, I am a lot on a good day. And back then I had very few good days. So I was really a lot. And I think that was a really interesting part of our relationship too, that changed, over the time that she was following me on the project. And I was always clear with her. I'm like, I'm not doing anything for your film. Like, you are following me. This is about me trying to heal from one of the worst things in my life. Like, you're making a film about it. Good luck. And, so yeah, I mean, the film is just kind of out there, and it's not the film I would have made, honestly. Like, there would be a little bit less my personal business in there. But I really wanted to also. I made a commitment to her, and I stuck with it of like, I'm not doing things for your film, but you also get to make the film that you want to make. And that's what she did. And from her perspective, where she's a little bit like, I'm not so sure about this restorative justice stuff, which I think is fine. Part of me is like, it's not for everybody, right? That is the difference between, I feel like, us and when people talk about retribution, they're like, retribution is justice. You're going to feel it, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I've experienced justice, and it's honestly to me one of the worst things in my life to again have. It's one of the worst things in my life that I ever prayed for someone to suffer, and then I found out that they did. Like, and to some people, they think that justice is going to make them feel better. I have talked to so many family members of murder victims who are so puzzled and think there's something wrong with them. Because someone gets incarcerated and they are punished and they don't actually feel better. And they're like, what's wrong with me? And I'm like, there's nothing wrong with you. It was not ever that light, or I guess I won't say never. There's nothing wrong with you. It was always very possible that you were going to feel just the same afterwards, because no amount of suffering inflicted on other people actually heals us. Maybe knowing that someone is somewhere where they cannot hurt us in that moment might heal for some people. And that's different, I think a different scenario. I think there's something to be said sometimes for distance between people. And that jail and prison sometimes is the only way we get that distance and that safety. But just putting someone in prison as punishment so that you will feel better is not that likely to happen. And I mean, that for me is, I think, I feel so different. There's so much of the shame and embarrassment that I was able to let go of through the process then of having the film out in the world. Because I'm like, well, now people know all of the like worst secrets about me. There's personal information about that film that most people would really try to keep private, and it was so interesting because Des and I talked about it, and I was like, you know what? It's true. Like, I don't have to hide from the truth. There's truths about me that are beyond my control. And yeah, there is a way in which I think that project just lifted so much of the shame and embarrassment off of me related, connected to this part of my life, to the murder. And I'm like, yeah, it healed me in ways that I really didn't anticipate, and my ongoing friendship, in particular, there's a former member of the RAF who's my good friend, and it's who I know genuinely cares about me, and I genuinely care about him. And there's a part of me that's like, honestly, like, I wish I could tell my brother. I'd be like, the world is so big and complex, and you were starting to get this look at it, But that is the point of being alive, is to realize like how big and complex like our hearts and our worlds can be. And I'm like, yeah, like, I'm gonna talk to him this weekend. My friend who's a former RAF member. Yeah, like he genuinely sometimes is like, I was thinking about you, and I was, and then I also am still friends with some of my, I mean, I'm friends with most of my dialogue partners, depending on their comfort with technology. I see some of them more often than others. I would say that's like the main factor that determines it. But it's funny. I wound up really fascinated by Germany, fascinated, and I think learned a lot from the history of the rise of Nazism, the factors of trauma that led to the rise of shared trauma, of the stories we tell each other about who's to blame for our suffering and what to do about it, and how that contributed to the rise of Nazism, and also really affected by, that I understand that the RAF played a role in how Germany ultimately has reckoned with Nazism in a way that very few places where genocidal acts have happened, have ever done. That Germany, the idea that I can go to Germany, that I can go to Berlin, and then in Berlin I can see a society grappling with the worst things they've done. Like I go there and I come back here and I talk to USers about it. I'm like, we could be like this about slavery. We could be like this about internment. We could be like this about the wars we have fought for aggression. Like we could. And they're not, like Germany is not worse off for it. I mean, I know some people will argue that it is, but I'm like, just like objectively, like I'm pretty sure not. There's so much to learn there, and my brother is this like really weird part of it, the point at which what the RAF was doing, had just kind of, just kind of like shrunken down to just the anger, and less about like the vision, the political vision, but yeah, I mean. And I think about it's so funny because what I tell people sometimes is that if they like before they watch my film at time my film excuse me before they watch Dez's film, what I tell people sometimes is before they watch Dez's film, maybe watch what is it, Der Staat gegen Fritz Bauer, and to watch that film to understand, and then I feel like maybe watch one of the RAF films, but I feel like they are so sensational, yeah, like Der Staat gegen Fritz Bauer, I feel like is really gives you this picture of what the RAF was rebelling against in a way that I don't think we really appreciate. And I would say a similar thing. By the way, it very much is what was happening in Germany in the 50s and what was happening in the United States in the 50s at the same time that led to the rise of the civil rights movement here and the second Reconstruction, was people being like, you just are planning to just move on and gloss over all of this harm. And that's not justice or healing either. It's not like, I'm not like, oh, the RAF just gets to do what they do. Like, I do still think there is conversation and action needed in response to the harms of RAF, of the RAF. I just don't think that killing them or throwing them into a prison and trying to make everyone forget about them is actually going to accomplish anything except for harming them and punishing them. So.
As part of your trip to Germany, how did it feel to come to Wiesbaden?
I have been to Frankfurt, but not Wiesbaden. I have passed on the train through Wiesbaden. Other places. And I was supposed to go to Wiesbaden in 2019, I want to say, because someone was doing a like an experimental theater piece at the university, and they invited me to come and be part of like a talk back. And I was planning to do it, and instead I got very sick. I got bronchitis, And I could barely breathe for like weeks. And so I had to cancel the trip. And then this is funny. I was like, you can always tell a small town. Oh my God, am I going to say this? And then I'm going to piss off people in Wiesbaden. I mean, the local paper was like, Kathleen was supposed to be here, but then didn't come. It's totally like, oh my God, I was so sick. It was constant conversation. Like, do I have to go to the hospital? And you're like, oh, you didn't come to our theater thing. Was that, wait, was that the local paper story? And then, yeah, I don't know. I have not been to Wiesbaden. I think there's a piece of different. When I first spoke with you, Thore, and you said that you were living in the building where my brother had been living, I was really blown away. It did not occur to me that such a thing was possible. I have not seen the site. I wrote to the United States government early in this project because I did want to understand more the investigation early in my restorative justice project, so around 2000, 2008 or 2009. And I asked them, here you can ask the government for anything, from a through a Freedom of Information request. And I asked them like for all the materials related to my brother's murder, and they sent me a full packet, and they sent me a really nice letter, actually. And again, this comes back to like the US Army is so sensitive about how they talk to people whose loved ones have been killed on active duty. And they wrote me a really nice letter, and they said, "We this is everything in the file except for the crime scene photos, which we are not including at this time to spare you. But if you want, you can request them, and we will send them right away." And then I decided, like, no, I don't. I already, I mean, part of me is like in my mind, always like the last vision I have of my brother is of him and of seeing his body when he came back to the United States. And so, yeah, it's funny. So I've almost gone to Wiesbaden at least twice, I want to say. And then, because then there was a film screening there for the film. Oh, that's right. And then my first child was born. I did not give birth to this child, but she was born, and so I couldn't be there either. And then, oh, and then the newspaper was like, Kathleen Picanha was supposed to be here. It's totally like, right. So the Wiesbaden newspaper is like, Kathleen Picanha doesn't exist. I don't know, like, but I think, I'm intrigued that the place my brother was last seen alive, is it still open, the Western Saloon, or
No, I don't think
no,
so.
it finally closed. Oh, like, did the pandemic close it?
I think it has to be closed for a long time because I can't remember it at all.
I think it's another place now.
Yes, I think so, yes.
Yeah.
But are you thinking about going to Wiesbaden sometime soon?
Oh yeah. At the moment, I have no plan to go to Wiesbaden, but I hope. I'm hoping to return to Germany with my family again. We were there as a family in 2023, and to return, hopefully in like 2026. And I don't, Frankfurt will be on the list. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the funniest things is I definitely have like gone for walks in the woods with, my friend who's a former member of the RAF, with another one of my dialogue partners who was not a member of the RAF but was a very avid supporter of the RAF at the time of my brother's murder. I mean, part of me thinks it's so funny that like that's just the most normal thing for me. Yeah, there is no way I could have told my 15-year-old self, someday you'll be older and like you'll be walking around with like some former member of the RAF, like, holding hands with your child. Like, yeah, that is, I would be like, that is bonkers. Like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? War and conflict are forever. And I'm like, right, like they're not. Like, it's our job, it's our responsibility to transform them, right? A part of me is like, it's our responsibility to transform harm, not to assume that it will never happen and that we're all perfect people, but that we're all deeply imperfect people who will make heinous mistakes. Part of me is like, my children are still young, but I'm like, you can already ask them about all the heinous mistakes I'm making as a parent. And I'm like, right, that we do. And we all need like a really unreasonable amount of grace. And that's, yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think, but all of that, you were like, you're going to Wiesbaden. I'm like, I don't know. I probably at some point I might take my kids there and they'll be like, Mommy, why are you crying so much? That, right, that will probably be, that will probably be the topic of conversation. But yeah, at the moment, like we go places and we go do the fun things and we learn about Nazism. So I don't, they're young to do the memorials, but I've, my wife has gone and gone to some of the museums and the memorials and has also remarked on like, you see them everywhere you go. Even from like the stumbling stones to, all these things. And I'm like, yeah, it is possible to acknowledge the harm that we've done in service of then of figuring out like how to repeat it as little as possible, which is hard, right? It is hard. I do, I think one of the funny things, if I come back to being like a storyteller, conflict is part of what makes stories interesting. Like I'm like, it is part of, we are hardwired for conflict. We are hardwired to make mistakes, right? We only learn by making mistakes. And so then how do you set up your life, your family, your world so that these mistakes aren't permanent? You can learn from them, and then sometimes that you're going to have the time and the attention to repair them, when you do them later. And I think that's what I keep trying to come back to, and with sometimes better than others. But yeah, and to just like take these big mistakes and just try and over time, like, take the best lessons that we can from them. I mean, I think that's for me, like, I'm sure that I've said and done some wrong things along the way on this journey as well. I'm sure that some of the other family members of RAF victims or some former members of the RAF do object to what I have said or done. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I might be wrong about some of these things. I know that I can live with myself more with what I've done. And that's, what I keep coming back to.
How was it for you to sit down with the RAF members and really listen to them? What did that ask of you?
I mean, if it is an important dialogue worth having, I tend to think it's going to be kind of terrifying. Like, I'm almost like, if it's not terrifying, then why would I be doing it? And I mean, I was really, I always, it's so funny because now, like now, for example, I will just name drop him. Like Lutz Telfer is my friend, and I mean, but I remember when I first, like when his first name first came up, I was like, who's this guy? And he is a, I mean, he's older now, but he was like a man of a certain age. And somebody even said to me, they were like, he is a German man of a certain age. Like, you need to not expect too much. And I was like, okay. And I mean, the night before, like, I couldn't sleep. I was like, what's he gonna say? Like, my heart is still kind of tender sometimes about it. Like, I mean, I still like think my brother was a wonderful human being. I'm still deeply sad that he's gone. I didn't know what to expect at all, and I laid awake the whole night, and I was really tired that, when we started that. But it was just so interesting how quickly, like, I realized he was just a really thoughtful person, like one of the most thoughtful people I could possibly ever talk about this with, about the RAF, because there's plenty of people. I mean, if so, I live in the United States. Right. So if people know about the RAF here, it is usually because they have some like very strong political feelings about the, or not even feeling, yeah, strong political feelings about the righteousness of the RAF. So usually when I talk to people on this side of the Atlantic Ocean who know the RAF well, they are fully prepared to tell me, you just need to understand the political ramifications of the action, the blah, blah, blah. You know, and so it was within a few minutes of starting to meet with him, I realized, like, oh, he knows all these things about the RAF, and he's not a jerk to me. Like, he is actually like, and that's where it comes back to sometimes. I don't know how to explain this to other people sometimes, except to say, like, a lot of times the people who understand the most, like what I've lost through the homicide of my brother, are people who've committed homicides. Like, those are the people who were like, I lay awake at night too, being like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to someone. This I've taken away something that can never be given back, you know, by ending this person's life. Like, those folks connected to homicide actually understand some of my pain. And I think within a few minutes of talking to Lutz, like, this became apparent that like I could ask him anything, and he could ask me things, and that he also genuinely wanted to understand. Like, that was one of the things too. Like, he had actually not had an opportunity ever before we sat down to speak to someone who'd lost a family member to the RAF. And I think he was fascinated that like someone came all the way from the United States to do it. Like, you know, and we also, I mean, part of what it takes is really great facilitators, and I cannot stress that enough. People try and do these dialogues on their own, and it's not, it's like, I mean, I want to say it's like cutting your own hair, but it's more like trying to like take out your own appendix. Like, do not, like, you need someone else who is not in the same kind of pain, but who can think about both people in the situation well, right? And not think, and I think thinking well about Lutz doesn't mean being like he didn't do anything. Like, he was definitely involved in the terrifying, violent deaths of other people, right? And he knows it. It's not about shielding him from that to think well of him. It is just understanding that, well, what sort of compassion would you want once you had done that, right? And we all want to live as if like, well, I could never do that. And a part of me is like, oh my God, I totally could wind up in that situation. And how would I want to be treated? And that's kind of how I proceed. And we had a really great facilitator, just really amazing facilitator. I can't speak enough about Annette's skill in this situation. And we had great, and she was also interpreting, and we had a great another second really thoughtful interpreter so that Lutz could speak in German and I could speak in English so that we could really minimize any misunderstandings through language. You know, and a part of me was like, I had to just keep saying to myself over and over again, like, I don't know what this is supposed to be like. I don't know what it's supposed to feel like. I just have to say to myself, I'm going to be with the unknown and see what happens. And that's really what made the biggest difference, and be like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what it's going to feel like, you know. And the more I'm able to stay in that space, the more I got out of the dialogues, is what I would say. And I would recommend it. I mean, the other thing, I have a long-running disagreement with many people in the restorative justice world who think that direct dialogues are better, that like once the two people who had been named by the criminal legal system in Germany as responsible for my brother's death, that I should have only focused on dialogue with them. I just had this conversation with someone recently, and they were like, I don't know about that sort of dialogue. You did, in English, we call it a surrogate dialogue. They're like, I don't know about that. I really think you can only get justice through a direct dialogue. And I was like, well, the problem is that justice can mean anything. I mean, anything you want it to mean. Healing is a different story. I want everyone to have an option for healing and an opportunity for healing. And I think surrogate dialogue offers that opportunity, but it is what you bring to it, like what you're able to sit with, how you're able to be with yourself and your own feelings. And surrogate dialogue is available to everyone. And then I'm not waiting. Like, I am not waiting for the only two people. I mean, Wolfgang Grams was likely involved in my brother's death. Well, he's dead. Can't direct dialogue with him. It's just, I just really encourage people to think about the ideas. What would it look like to have this conversation with someone who's like on the other side, but not directly opposite you? Because there is a way that it opens up opportunities that don't exist any other way, for understanding. And that people think that understanding means you're gonna, become like, I don't know. I actually don't know what people are worried about. I'm trying to, what did I used to be? I used to be worried that it would mean a betrayal to my brother. And I'm like, my brother did not want my life to end. He wanted my life to keep getting bigger. And I'm like, this is, and surrogate dialogue, this way of, so doing a surrogate dialogue, taking the time to understand my own experience and understand someone else's perspective on it, really changed me. And understanding, like, Lutz was in prison with like no support, except from what he got from the outside. And he wrote to the people on the outside who were his supporters and told them they were wrong for killing my brother. Like, that's intense, right? Like, he, like, I mean, in English, would say, like, he threw down for my brother and my family, knowing that I existed out there, even without even knowing who I was. And I'm like, a part of me is like, well, what am I gonna do? What am I ever gonna do that's gonna match that? Right? Being in the loneliest place and then telling your support people, when you did that, that was wrong. When you did this to this other guy that I have no idea who he is, he means nothing to me other than he's a young man who had a life ahead of him. Like, a part of me is like, what am I? Yeah, what am I ever going to do that's going to compare to taking a moral stand in that moment like he did? And then I was like, right, it raises the bar for me and what I have to do to say that I'm committed to justice. So, and I could never have experienced that without being in dialogue with him.
In one of our earlier conversations, Wolfgang Krauser urged Birgit Hogefeld to share more details about the circumstances surrounding Edward's murder. What are your thoughts about this, on this? Do you think it could help with the healing process?
I think a lot sometimes about how sad, just how sad and not like the rest, or maybe too much like the rest of his life, the last like hour or minutes of my brother's life were. And I don't, along the lines of like, I don't think that anyone is a, whatever, how to put it. I think asking me to describe something I've done where I knew I was hurting someone, or I looked back and knew it, like, I would think that I could not be that accurate. Right? Like, so A, I don't think it would be that accurate to have someone describe it. And I don't think it would be that helpful. And I know that some family members of murder victims then, and again, like, I've kind of had this conversation with different people in a lot of different situations. I've also seen where then basically, if they like, they say things that then people don't accept. They're like, well, that can't be true. And so part of me is, I feel like it's a distraction. I don't think it necessarily helps with healing. There was a, yeah, because then it just winds up seeming like the person might be saying things that are self-serving. I mean, that is, again, the hard part about direct dialogue. I remember now Wolfgang Klaushauer and my interaction with him, which was that I told Wolfgang Klaushauer about the film before, that Des was coming to do filming before I told Birgit. Because it, originally, when I was going to Germany, like, I thought I was going to meet with Birgit. And it was because I wanted to have a couple of interactions with her before I even told her there was a film, because I wanted her to feel like she could not participate. And before I could do that, Wolfgang Klaushauer told her about the film. And that is why Birgit refused to meet with me. So I'm like, so I'm just going to say Wolfgang Klaushauer He's not my favorite person because that to me was deeply unprofessional. I did not ask him to convey anything to Birgit Haugefeld, and he did. And so, or if I did ask him to convey anything, it was not that. It was that, in fact, I was very adamant that I did not want to discuss anything leading up to the murder. Because also, especially like in 2010, 2011, when we were doing this, when I was getting this project together, like there was another new prosecution that was emerging for another former RAF member. And so I was very aware, like, we can't talk about anything leading up to the acts because I don't want to become the pretense for the German government issuing a new indictment. And so I had all of these things in mind about how to create a safe space for Ms. Haugefeld. And then Wolfgang Klausauer was like, well, I told her. And then suddenly she just stopped talking to me because I think she was like, well, I can't trust you because you're making a film. And again, I was not making a film. I was doing a project and my friend was going to come film it. And I did put limits on Des. I was like, anytime something's not being filmed, like, you don't get it. I don't care if it helps your film or not. And she was like, I can deal with that. And that was the agreement we had. And then, but the only thing I have to say is, on the one hand, Wolfgang Klausauer is not my favorite person. And he really messed up that project. But then once I couldn't meet with Birgit Haugefeld, then that was what created then the surrogate dialogues. So in that respect, thank you, Wolfgang Klausauer. Because if I had just had the direct dialogue, or if I'd gone all that way and then had the direct dialogue and it didn't work out as well, I didn't have a facilitator back then either. Like, it was just all a mess. So yeah, part of me is, oh, that's right. Thank you, Wolfgang Klausauer. Because it put the brakes on everything. And then we spent like, I want to say I spent like a year being like, what am I possibly going to do? And then I got the facilitator totally through chance, which is so frustrating, right? That's the whole thing. There aren't systems to help people do this because it's not the story that we tell ourselves about how people will find healing. And that to me is deeply frustrating. Like, it should just be that if, in fact, people really care about the healing of people who've lost family members to homicide, then make things available to us, give us options. It shouldn't be that, I had fundraisers to pay for my ticket to go there. Like, I just had to scrape everything together. And also, like, I had a great facilitator. I had not less than 10 people checking in with me constantly during that trip, being like, how are you? I care about you. How is this going for you? Is it turning out like you thought? To which the answer is always like, no, not at all. Nothing was what I thought it would be like. And yeah, it takes a great facilitator. It takes a strong family and community, and without that, people don't get the options I've had. And I feel very aware of that. Like, part of my work is also to make these options available to as many people as possible. No one has to do it, but I want people to get to choose it from the available opportunities.
So, did I get it right? You wouldn't choose to do the film again, but you would still take part in the dialogues and meetings?
I'll just say I wouldn't change anything. I wouldn't change anything. What's the point? If I would change anything, I'd be like, my brother wasn't murdered. Like, everything since then, I'm just gonna kind of roll with, but yeah, I wouldn't even like I said, even Wolfgang Klausauer, like, interfering with the direct dialogue turned out to be a great thing. A lot of times I just feel like I'm, really, really blessed. I will say too, one of my absolute favorite things about the film is when the Danicamp reached out to us, because the Danicamp had multiple screenings of the film and multiple conversations about what they wanted to do when it came to the use of violence or the threat of violence in their activism. And that for me, honestly, was just such a fascinating set of conversations to get to listen to and to get to be a part of. They're just such thoughtful young activists. Many of them didn't even know about the RAF, right? Which is wild. You're like, oh, everyone, at one point, every German of a certain age from the former West Germany knows the RAF. A lot of these young people didn't. But they just had such thoughtful questions. for themselves, and the questions that I totally wish people were asking in movement, which is, yes, we will get more attention if we use violence, but at what cost? To ourselves, to the people that we might harm? What would we have to do or make right? They also, as an encampment, they were talking about issues of, well, how do we create safety and healing in our own space? So I'd say one of my absolute favorite things about the film is the way the Denny Kemp activists were able to use it as a tool for their own work, and yeah, and really, being fascinated by their work and what they were able to figure out.
In Wiesbaden, there will likely be a memorial plaque for Edward soon. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I think it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. And I find myself being like, what would my mother think? I mean, I think my mother thinks she loved him and went to a lot of trouble to raise him and so that he could have his own life. So I think, I don't know. What would he think? I think he'd think like, what? I think if anything, it's so funny. When people are killed in the US military, families are kind of left in this place of being like, well, the only comfort you can get is they died. The phrases they say a lot, defending our way of life. They died for a value. And I think, my brother, on the one hand, was not killed in an actual war. The RAF felt like they were at war. The US government calls them terrorists. But I would say, and I'm not sure either that he like died, died defending our way of life. The conflict in which we were in, the Cold War at the time, like was resolved through other means. But if I would think if he was memorialized in any way, it would be to acknowledge that he was interested and curious. He was curious to know and learn from German people. And he was curious about the people of Wiesbaden. And I hope that, and when I tell myself, like, what did he die defending? I'm like, did he make this horrible mistake? Is it horrible to assume when you meet people that they're not like about to kill you as part of like an international political plot? Like, yes, I think we should proceed with our lives the way my brother did, and assume that the vast majority of the time you're going to meet people that are as interested in you as you are in them, and in fact not like the sort of like judgy jerks that they were, because then they, I mean, I'm sure you've re read the communique that they wrote later, where they were like, well, he lacked a political analysis. At which point I'm just like, well, when did that become a capital crime? But anyway, yet I digress. Okay, hold on. I mean, if there's a memorial, I think it's that he was curious and interested in the people of Wiesbaden. He didn't see himself as anything other than like a young person learning about the world and lucky to get to learn about it and lucky to start his exploration of the world in Germany. Because yeah, he was excited. He had a choice of three postings, and when he got Germany, he's like, this is going to be great. I think it's going to be really cool there. And for a while it was. So yeah, I think that's what I would want him remembered for, that idea that he liked the people of Wiesbaden.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. It's truly inspiring to see how you've taken such a tragic and complex experience and transformed it into something that we can all learn from and grow as people.
Yep. I feel like we've covered it all. As someone who does these transcripts too, I'm like, oh my, what have I done to you? But I really appreciate your interest in this whole project. I never cease to be amazed by the complexity that people bring to conversations there. That is really, we are headed in the opposite direction here, as you know. I know. You say, of course, but I'm like, we are literally on the road to hell over here.
Thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it and I wish you all the best. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Das war die vorerst letzte Folge unserer digitalen Gesprächsreihe. Gebt uns gern Feedback, ob ihr Interesse an weiteren Folgen habt. Und bis dahin sagen wir alles Gute und es bleibt nur noch der Dank beim Kulturamt der Landeshauptstadt Wiesbaden zu sagen, die mit ihrer institutionellen Förderung dieses Projekt ermöglichten.